This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Last week on this program, we discussed changes in military medicine and the way that is shaping the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Military surgeons have been able to get closer to the line of fire to treat battlefield wounds and then transport the injured to combat hospitals in record time. That, combined with advances in protective gear, is keeping alive many who might otherwise have died in previous conflicts. Today, a look at what happens to the injured, especially those with severe wounds, once they return to the United States. We'll be talking about the nature of the injuries these men and women suffer and about what the military and the VA is doing to ease the transition from able-bodied soldier to wounded civilian. If you're an injured soldier or have a family member that is, what issues have you grappled with since returning to the U.S.? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, TOTN@npr.org. To start off, we turn to Lance Corporal David Coleman. He was severely wounded in Iraq this September. He joins us by phone from his home in Butte, Montana. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Maybe we could go back to the moment you were injured. Tell us how you were injured first.
I was injured in an IED blast, leaving Terbil, Iraq to go to Korean Village to get resupplied. The IED blast took off 80% of my calf and left me with a lot of damage on my left and right leg.
Do you remember much about the moment? Did you receive treatment immediately? We've been hearing about how quickly some of these military units can get to people in the field. Did they get to you quickly?
Well, yes, to a point. What happened was when the blast occurred, you know, I was deaf at the moment. There was a lot of dust and confusion, and I could taste blood and sweat. There was a corpsman that was sitting to my left before the blast, who was, you know, the field doctor we had. And when the blast occurred, all the dust had confused my line of sight. I had no idea where anybody was. There was just a lot of dust. And I stood up to try to spot where I was or try to shoot back if there was any enemy. And I fell right on my butt. It was then I realized both my legs were broken. And so when the dust cleared and I found the doc, I told him, hey, doc, my legs are broken. He had a look at me right there and then. He elevated my legs. He put them on the shoulders of my best friend, Lance Corporal Duncan, Mark Duncan. And he used a thing called quick clot on my right leg because blood was pouring out of my leg. He had cut away my uniform and put on quick clot on my right leg, which stopped the bleeding immediately. From there, he bandaged it up as well as he could. And then he looked at my left leg and bandaged that up as well as he could. And then he had to move on to the others who were injured.
And all this time, I gathered, then you must have been in shock. It sounds like you weren't feeling the pain at that moment.
Right. I wasn't. I was in shock, and I could have died from the shock if the choppers hadn't responded so quickly.
So the choppers came very fast then, also, you're saying?
They did.
You really did get the kind of medical treatment that we've been talking about. It sounds like it came to you pretty swiftly, and then they got you out of there fast at the same time. Where did you go then? Where did you go from the battlefield?
After I left there, I went to Al-Asad Air Base on the helicopters. That's where they did. I didn't go to Al-Asad. I went to Korean Village, where initially I was going at the field hospital, where they gave me more morphine and catheter, and they had looked at the wounds and replaced the bandages and did what they could to repair the damage. After that, I was flown to Al-Asad Air Base, which was my first surgery. What they did there was they did a cleaning and debridement. They had cut away flesh that was too torn to replace, and they removed a lot of the metal and the bone that was just lying everywhere in my leg and put on an external fixator, which kept the broken bones in place so that they wouldn't move around while moving me to other hospitals for surgery.
Once you realized how severe your injuries were, what were you thinking? What were your first thoughts about it?
I didn't realize how serious my injuries were until I got to Germany. And my first thoughts first turned to God, and I prayed, and then they turned to my family.
Were you thinking about your future? When did you begin to think about that?
When I got to Washington, D.C.
And how long how long was it between the time you were injured and the time you got to Washington, D.C.?
I was injured on September 24th, and I believe I got to Washington, D.C. late October, early August. November, I think. Yeah, late August, early November.
So it was then that you started thinking, what does this mean to my life, this injury? Is when those thoughts started really coming to you?
Yes, it is. And it didn't really bother me so much because I realized I wasn't the only one injured. I was traveling with guys who were more injured than I was, who are already missing limbs, guys who were not expected to live past the night, but every night they made it, you know. And I looked at my injury and I said, this is fixable. These guys have irreparable damage done to them.
Now,
these guys who are blown in half, who won't have children now.
I know at one point the possibility existed that your leg might have to be amputated. Is that still a possibility, or have you gotten past the point where that's being considered? Have you advanced enough that that's not being considered anymore? What's your status now?
They saved my leg as well as they could. They said I have a 50-50 shot of losing it if it gets infected. Chances of it getting infected with the antibiotics that they gave me are pretty slim, however.
And you are no longer in Washington. You're in your hometown in a hospital there?
Yes. Well, not the hospital. I'm actually at my home with my parents, recuperating. I have to see a physical therapist every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and a orthopedics doctor every Wednesday.
And as far as you know, your surgeries are through at this point, and the emphasis now is what, on physical rehabilitation, physical therapy?
I have one more surgery in January where they're going to replace 5 inches of missing bone, missing nerve, and they're going to stretch my Achilles tendon so I can walk on it. And after that surgery, then it's going to be emphasized on walking again, getting around again.
Okay, so you still have to face one more surgery.
That's it.
How are you getting around now at home?
On crutches and a wheelchair.
So you are actually walking around on crutches then? Your other leg is strong enough to use crutches?
Yes, it is.
Now,
they saved that one quickly. After I left Al-Assad, the left leg was ready to walk on right after that.
What's your status in the military at this point? Are you still under the care of the military? Have you moved on to Veterans Affairs medical benefits? What's your status there?
I'm still active duty military, pending a medical board investigation, and they're investigating my disability to see how disabled I am for, I believe, you know, medical compensation and all that.
How old are you?
I'm only 20 years old.
20. And what would you like to do? Are you making plans?
Yes, I am. I plan on going to the University of Southern California.
And what do you want to do there?
I'm going to study film.
Film?
I want to learn how to direct it, just direct anything, commercials, news, movies, anything. Just become a director and I'll be happy.
That's great. And but I understand, too, that you'd like to stay in the Marines if you could. Is that right?
Yes, to a point. I'd like to be in the Marines if I can be with the guys that saved my life. If I can be with my old unit, I'd still want to be in the Marine Corps. If I can't be with my buddies, then I don't want to stay in.
Well, David, thanks so much for being with us and for all you've done for us.
Thank you.
And I wish you good health. I hope that everything works out in your next surgery.
You too. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. David Coleman is a Marine. He was wounded in Iraq in September, and he joined us by phone from his home in Butte, Montana. And joining us now to get a broader sense of how troops like David Coleman are faring once they return to the U.S., we turn now to Nancy Shute. She's a senior writer for U.S. News & World Report. She's written about the treatment that men and women wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan are receiving, and she joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here, Lynn.
How typical critical was that story that we just heard of what the troops are experiencing when they're wounded and the care that they get and the situation they find themselves in?
Lynn, I think quite remarkably, it is typical. What we found, we spent several months really trying to find out what kind of medical care the troops are getting, you know, what gaps there might be, and also what the transition, what coming home is like for these soldiers once they are wounded. And the sense is that the military is doing a terrific job of getting medical care into the field really quickly, saving lives of people that wouldn't have been saved before with some technological advances like Quick Clot, this material they used on David's leg so he wouldn't bleed to death. That's the thing that's most likely to kill you when you're injured on a battlefield is bleeding to death. Then getting you out of there fast. I met David when he was actually in the hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, 4 days after he was injured. And 2 days later, he was on a plane back to Andrews Air Force Base in Washington. So they're moving folks through really quickly and giving them extraordinarily good health care, it seems. I think the big question is, what happens down the line? This is the biggest influx of wounded soldiers we've seen since Vietnam. Mm. And are we prepared to take care of those people as we should?
And with we've been talking about the fact that there's advances both in the medical care they're getting and in their equipment. So what kind of injuries are they seeing now that perhaps they wouldn't have seen before? That, as you mentioned before, he might have died from bleeding to death. What kinds of, are the injuries that are people surviving more severe injuries now? What are we seeing in terms of that?
Yes, they are, Lynn. What we're seeing is that because the body armor has improved and because the soldiers are wearing it, which is not true in previous wars, the death rate has dropped. The death rate is 22% lower than it was just in Gulf War I, which was barely a decade ago. But people are surviving with really severe injuries to their extremities, severe head injuries, severe eye injuries, things that are going to take a lot of time, or burns. The IEDs tend to cause the kind of devastating damage that David had to his leg, also burns, crushing. One physician I talked to likened this to getting run through a piece of farm machinery. I mean, these are not the kind of things you see in a car crash.
And they're not the kinds of injuries that people would have survived in past wars?
No, it looks like from so far, it's still early to tell because it's very hard for the military to gather, you know, real-time data from the battlefield. But it does look like people are surviving at a higher rate than they did before. And that means there's going to be more people to take care of, which is good news. But the question is, what kind of care are they going to get? And it seems that, you know, the military has a system called medical hold, where if you come back, like David, and you're severely injured, they wait to see if you are going to be fixable and can be of use to the military and can be returned to active duty. Even the head of the VA called that another world. A lot of soldiers languish there for a year. 23% of the reserve people who have entered med hold are still there. And you're basically parked in an Army base, sometimes doing make work, sometimes just sitting on your butt. And it's really frustrating, particularly for the reserve folks who do have a life and do have jobs back home that they can't get to.
And the reserve troops also tend to be older, and sometimes that affects their medical situation as well.
Exactly. You see, you know, one of the docs I talked to at Landstuhl said they're treating soldiers for cataracts, which you don't see with the young active duty guys.
Yeah. We are talking about battlefield injuries and what happens when the injured return home. We'll be taking your calls. The number, of course, 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Or you can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about how troops injured in Iraq are dealing with recovery. My guest is Nancy Shute, a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She recently wrote a special report on treating those who are wounded in Iraq. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Nancy, we just heard from David Coleman, who was injured in Iraq in September, that you know, if he could, and if everything worked out, he might want to stay in the military. Is that something that you often hear?
Yes, Lynn. I was surprised with the soldiers we talked to. I was surprised with the soldiers that we talked to that even severely injured soldiers say, I would really like to go back. I want to try to finish the job that I joined the military to do. And it seems like that's not unusual. However, soldiers, like David said, also don't want to go back if they can't do the job.
Yeah.
And I think that the Army is trying harder to keep injured soldiers, find things for them to do. But if what you were doing was jumping out of airplanes, that's hard to do with a prosthesis.
Yeah. Now, I understand that there's two different medical systems. There's the military medical system, and then there's the VA medical system, and that they actually have two different boards to decide how much disability a soldier might get. How does that work? Tell us what happens when an injured veteran leaves the military and then goes into the VA.
You actually have to negotiate your way between two separate military medical boards, one for the military to decide if you should get a medical discharge and what your disability rating is. Then you have to go through a whole separate system with the VA. You have to apply for disability benefits, apply for medical benefits. It's not automatic. There's a lot of duplication in that system. There's been a lot of effort over the years to try to get rid of that duplication from Congress, from a variety of sources. But it's still a rocky road, and a soldier has to have a lot of wherewithal to get through that on their own.
Yeah, and then we've been talking about the fact that some of those people who are surviving with very, very serious injuries, perhaps some that will require care for a lifetime. Is the VA ready to do that? Can they handle those cases?
I think there's a lot of concern among the service organizations and even within the VA itself. The VA has almost doubled the number of patients they've been taking care of in recent years. And, you know, money in the federal budget is tight. Everybody who knows the VA healthcare system says they do a great job. The problem is that it's tough to get in, and often you have to wait quite a while to get service. The question is, if you're adding more vets, severely injured vets, vets with PTSD, a lot of complicated problems, how is there going to be enough care to go around?
All right, let's take a call now from Bob. He's in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm a physician in the military, and my concern and my question, I guess, is what is your what has Nancy found out in terms of specifically the mental health, the long-term care? You just mentioned it in terms of the VA, but what specifically is being done in terms of trying to take care of these soldiers for long-term? The soldiers I've taken care of that have come back, and I've been deployed myself, the thing I think that we lack the most in is that long-term piece.
There's huge concern about both long-term care and mental health care. Some studies have said that 20% of the soldiers coming back from Iraq have PTSD. Many don't start having real problems till a few years down the line. And the General Accounting Office asked the VA a while ago, saying, how about this, you know, taking care of PTSD patients? And the VA wasn't even able to say how many PTSD patients they were taking care of now. So the question is, then how can you possibly know if you're prepared to deal with more?
Bob, what kinds of situations are you seeing? You said you are treating some...
We see, and again, I'm saying this unofficially. I'm not officially speaking, just sort of as a caller now. But we see patients where I am in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, sort of the end of the evacuation line. And I think that by the time they get to us, most of their major physical wounds have been well taken care of. But when we get into the long term issues, that's where I feel the system has a hard time dealing with it. And so I myself, as a provider, feel that, you know, inadequate and that I've not fully provided the psychological piece to them, and sort of the long-term, like chronic pain, for example, is also a part of that psychological issue, the mental health issue. A lot of them have chronic pain and disabling symptoms from these wounds that they've suffered, And those things are very hard to take care of and require maybe sometimes lifelong care.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call, Bob.
Thank you.
The VA is still dealing with people from the war in Vietnam. It's still
dealing with World War II veterans. And that's another problem, too, because they're dealing with Vietnam and World War II veterans. These are guys who need hip replacements, who have prostate cancer. And you're talking a whole different patient population if you're talking about 25-year-olds with PTSD, with severe chronic pain.
PTSD?
Oh, post-traumatic stress disorder. Right. Psychological problems as a result of the stresses of combat.
Okay, one of the injuries that troops are returning home with right now are severe injuries to the heads. George Zitney is the director of Virginia NeuroCare. That's a nonprofit which treats both troops and civilians with head wounds. He's with us now by phone from his office in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Now, I know that you treated soldiers from the Persian Gulf War. What are you seeing now that's different from then?
Well, I think, first of all, in the Persian Gulf War, there were very few people with head trauma. In this particular war, there's a significant increase in injuries to the head, primarily caused by blast injuries, so that we're seeing something quite new and novel, and this is perhaps because of all of the explosive devices that are being used and the grenade attacks and the rocket attacks that are being done. So what happens is that these individuals who are having these blast injuries wind up with cognitive problems, memory problems, and obviously disorientation and a wide range of issues that relate to how well one could think, make decisions, participate in society. So these are serious problems.
And these are problems that they are likely to have for their whole lives, or can...
There are individuals, for example, who may have a mild brain injury. The mild brain injury, with a lot of compensatory strategies, with help, neurorehabilitation, will be able to either return to active duty or will return to school or some employment in their community. But for the majority of them, these are lifelong injuries.
And even those who have mild, what might be described as mild head injuries right now, head injuries can come back to haunt you later on in life, can they not?
Well, head injuries, particularly mild head injuries, it's really almost a misnomer because there's no such thing as a mild head injury. But with a mild head injury, you could have cognitive problems in terms of figuring out how to do complex reasoning. You also might have severe headaches that last for a lifetime. There's other kinds of complications that come up as you age as a result of a head injury. So these are problems that are very significant.
Now, your organization is working in partnership with the Defense Department, is that right?
Yes, Virginia NeuroCare works as a core member of the Defense and Veterans Head Injury Program. And we provide both inpatient and extensive therapy in terms of getting people back into the community after they've had a head injury in the military.
And you focus on rehabilitation, is that right?
We focus on neurorehabilitation.
And what does that entail, neurorehabilitation?
Neurorehabilitation really means if you've had an injury to the head, it depends upon where the lesion occurred within the brain. And so if it was a frontal injury, for example, you'd have problems with what is known as executive function. So those are the kinds of things about decision-making, to do abstract reasoning, things like that. So what we would do there is that we would concentrate on helping an individual learn how to manage their checkbook, how to go shopping, how to negotiate a bank, all those things that we take for granted. If it's a more serious injury that affects parts of the brain that deal with speech, the speech center or the vision center or the hearing center or the balance center, we provide a full range of therapies, everything from occupational therapy to physical therapy, vocational counseling, you name it, we provide it. And the whole idea is to get these individuals back into the community to ease their way back in. So it is a very significant opportunity for these young men and women coming from Iraq and Afghanistan to get a second chance to get back into their family, to get back into community, to get back to work.
If you can just hold on a second, I'm going to take a call now from Cade in Columbus, Ohio. Cade, hello.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to ask, I don't know if it's important, I think, for people who will not be able to work again, how much they will receive to survive as a money?
All right, thanks for your question, Kate. Let me ask George Zitney about that in terms of rehabilitation, to what degree are you trying to rehabilitate people so that they will be able to work again?
We have had terrific success with these individuals. Of the 53 individuals that we have so far served here in Charlottesville, Virginia, at Virginia NeuroCare, we've been able to get almost all of them back to some type of activity. Now, it may not be paid work, but it's going to be work that's going to be satisfactory and it's going to give them a sense of quality of life. But a vast majority of them go back to paid employment. In fact, some of them go back into the military if they have the ability and if that is their desire.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us today. George Zitney is the director of Virginia NeuroCare. That's a nonprofit that treats injured troops with severe head wounds. He joined us by phone from his office in Charlottesville, Virginia. And let me just ask you, Nancy, to answer the question of that caller who was saying how much money are they going to get depending on what their disability is. I mean, it's a pretty complicated process, the answer to that question, I think.
It is, Lynn. The schedule, the VA schedule for disability compensation is about 100 pages long. It's one of these arcane texts.
100 pages long?
Yes.
For each soldier?
The system, and it's like, you know, how much of your hand is missing, how many limbs, you know, it's one of these complicated equations. If you get 100% disability rating, if you're severely injured, you're given $2,239 a month, tax-free. There's other things you would get, including help for nursing care and things like that. So there's additions to that. But that's the base of what you would expect if you got 100% disability rating.
Right. And is this where both the military makes a decision and the veterans makes a decision separately, or do they make it in conjunction with each other?
No, they do it separately. And vets really have to balance it because taking the military compensation can affect what you get from the VA. Some is tax-free, some is not. It's complicated, and the service organizations like the American Legion spend a lot of time doing volunteer work helping vets just figure out these complicated questions.
Helping veterans with severe amputations is another issue the VA will have to grapple with as more wounded arrive home. With us now to discuss that is Dr. Roy Aaron, a professor of orthopedic surgery at Brown Medical School in Providence, Rhode Island. He's heading a research project funded by the VA to restore arm and leg functions to amputees. He joins us by phone from his office in Providence. First of all, are we seeing more amputations now, Dr. Aaron, than we've seen in past conflicts?
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for asking me to join you. What we're seeing in the way of limb injuries, including amputations, is a function of the success of battlefield surgery as well as body armor, so that while the total number of amputations that we're seeing is not higher than before, the percentage is higher because soldiers are surviving wounds that would have been fatal in the past, and so they return with substantial limb injuries and associated disabilities.
And you are working on prosthetics that would tell us what you're working on.
Well, our research program is multifaceted. We're really looking at improved prosthetic devices, but also improved control of the prosthetic devices by the user so that the user's intent is sensed by the device and the overall function is improved. We're also looking at the interface between the user and the device to make those much more user-friendly and functionally able.
And to what extent would you say that the VA is equipped to deal with the severity of the injuries that people are coming back with to their legs and their arms?
Well, the VA has traditionally been a leader in rehabilitation research, and I think that as far as agencies in this country are concerned, they're very well positioned to do this. However, in general, rehabilitation research has not been a national priority. And necessity typically drives medical attention and research. And so as a unfortunate byproduct of this war, there is increasing attention to both limb function restoration and prosthetic design and rehabilitation at both military hospitals and the VA.
Dr. Roy Aaron is professor of orthopedic surgery at Brown Medical School in Providence, Rhode Island, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Brown, to what degree do you think you will be successful in terms of helping some of these people with these severe injuries to be able to function at a very high level? You know, we see we're getting used to now seeing things like tracks, people running track with prosthetic devices, but I imagine they're extremely expensive, these kinds of things. I mean, will a public medical system be able to provide people with those kinds of really high-tech solutions?
That, of course, is a function of national health priorities. If you speak to the military surgeons and other people who are caring for these individuals, of course, they want these expensive microprocessor-controlled implants and prosthetic devices to be available for their patients. I would say that from the treatment perspective, the thing that we're most concerned with is optimizing the interface between the device and the user. So particularly in traumatic amputations, as we're seeing in these wars, some of these amputations are too high or at inappropriate levels for the user to properly use a prosthetic device. And we hope to do things involving tissue engineering to lengthen limbs to enable the appropriate wearing and use of the currently available devices.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Aaron.
Thank you.
Dr. Roy Aaron is a professor of orthopedic surgery at Brown Medical School. He's heading a research project funded by the VA to restore arm and leg functions to amputees. He came to us by phone from Providence, Rhode Island. Nancy Shute, one thing I was struck by in some of what you have written about this in some of your conversations with these very severely injured young men and women as well, is how hopeful they are about the future. Were you struck by that yourself as you talked with them?
Yes, I really was. I know that everyone that we spoke to in the course of working on this has their dark days. It would be extraordinarily difficult, I think, to one moment be young and strong and doing a dangerous, complicated job, and the next moment find yourself flat on your back in a stretcher getting thrown onto a transport plane. Really no idea of what lay ahead of you. It's a tremendous testament to the resilience and hopefulness of these people.
And they come from a generation where if they know there's a prosthetic device available to them, as we've just been hearing about, they're going to fight for that, I would think. They're going to push for that.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we're in the age of, internet medicine, where even if you're in Butte, Montana, like David Coleman is, you're going to be aware of what's available and what your options are.
Okay, thanks so much. Nancy Shute is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She's going to stay with us, and when we come back from a short break, we'll finish this discussion, and we'll hear about another story about the impact of the war, the number of children who have lost a parent in the conflict in Iraq. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Right now, we're talking about troops wounded in the conflict in Iraq and what they face coming home. Nancy Shute is still with us. She's a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. You can join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from the Department of Veterans Affairs is Dr. Michael Cussman. He's the Acting Deputy Undersecretary for Health at the Department. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Cussman.
Thank you for asking me.
We've been hearing on this program about so many young men and women with very severe injuries. How is the Department of Veterans Affairs able to cope with this this development?
Well, we understand this is our obligation, and we will continue to do whatever is necessary to take care of these heroes.
Dr. Cussman, are you on a speakerphone?
We're okay now.
Okay.
last summer, we initiated a new program where we put VA benefits counselors and Veterans Affairs social workers in several of the military treatment facilities that are taking care of these heroes to partner with the Department of Defense personnel to assist in the transition in the continuum of care as they leave the Department of Defense and transition to the VA facilities.
Now, we've also been hearing that some of these veterans may need lifetime care, may need some level of support, medical support for, throughout their lives. Is this something that the VA is prepared for, and do you have the resources for that?
Oh, I think we have all the resources that we need right now to take care of these patients. This is our job. The Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs is the organization that does take care of service members for their needs throughout their lives. We are really at the forefront of being able to take care of people with polytrauma that has existed, especially in this war. And we're very proud of our ability to take care of people with traumatic brain injury, amputations, vision problems, spinal cord injuries, and mental health.
We've also been talking about the fact that there's a pretty complicated bureaucracy set up for soldiers to find out just what level of disability they may be at, that there's the military system as well as the VA system. Are you starting to work on perhaps simplifying that, joining the two systems in any way?
Yes, ma'am. I alluded to that already, where by putting our personnel in the military facilities, we're assisting them with that process to be sure there is as much coordination as possible. But there is a process in the military for a physical evaluation board that sets what the military is giving them, and then there's a compensation and pension exam that the VA does. And we've recently signed a memorandum of agreement with the Department of Defense to try to facilitate and do this process in sync, where they'll only need one physical examination.
All right, let's take a call now from Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I'm a geriatric social worker, and my dad is a POW from World War II through the VA system. And my question is, I know that you just answered that, can the VA cope with the onslaught of people from this war? My dad's experience has been mixed. I think that the VA system is an extraordinary system. However, the compensation system is a bureaucratic nightmare. And how are you going to cope with Vietnam on top of the Gulf War, on top of this war?
Dr. Cressman?
Yes, well, first of all, I'd like to thank the caller's dad for his great service that he...
Getting a little feedback. Dr. Cressman?
Yeah. I'm not sure where that was coming from, but... But we are working as hard as we can to be very proactive to expedite the benefits process. There's a process under which you have to go through, but we believe that we're able to handle all these incoming new casualties. We see we've seen about 30,000 Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom personnel. We normally take care of about 5 million patients a year, and so we believe that although every one of these patients are important to us, we believe that they're distributed throughout the country, and there's no one place that will be overwhelmed, and we should be able to provide whatever care is needed for these people in an expeditious manner.
All right, thanks so much. Let's go to Greg. He is in Great Falls, Montana. Hi, Greg.
Yes, my question is, with all the new technology we have, saving all these kids, bringing them all back, or being dismembered, you know, amputees, do we have a plan for the suicide rate going up? Are these kids, you know, is there a plan in place?
As I mentioned, that the treatment for mental health problems related to the conflict as well as the injuries is in place and very aggressively being instituted.
Okay, well, just you know, those concern I've always had about these kids.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call, Greg. And we're going to go to Jim, and he's calling from Vermont. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Question, comment. I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and I use the VA here in White River Junction, Vermont, which is the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And... when my understanding is that when our reservists and National Guards people come back from Iraq, Afghanistan, or Bosnia, that if they had their own medical insurance, when they go to the VA hospital, they are asked for their own private insurance card. They are not given the priority of a VA card, as I am and my fellow veterans are.
Okay, Jim, I'm going to ask Dr. Cussman if he can answer your question. Thanks so much for your call. Dr. Cussman?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Everybody that is served in the combat theater of operations, when they come back, can be seen at the VA for up to 2 years for anything that occurred in that theater of operations, no questions asked. So I'm a little puzzled by that. They're treated as a fairly high priority in the system, and it doesn't make any difference whether they have outside insurance or not. I mean, they're treated just like any other veteran who served in combat.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Cussman.
Thank you for asking me.
Dr. Michael Cussman is the Acting Deputy Undersecretary for Health at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And Nancy Shute, before you go, what have you been hearing from the soldiers you've been interviewing? Have they even gotten to the point of being under the Veterans Administration yet, or are they still mostly under the care of the military? And are the problems really is the VA as ready to handle some of these things as Dr. Cussman seems confident they are?
Lynn, I think it's too early to tell, but we are seeing some troubling signs. He mentioned that 30,000 vets have applied for VA benefits. About a third of those, about 10,000, are still waiting to get their approval for disability benefits. And there's two big problems with the VA. One is waiting to get that disability ranking. You only get health care for service-related disabilities, not for other problems that may come up. The second is that you have to wait a long time to go in and see a doctor. It varies a lot from different places in the country. But there's already a lot of problems, as that one caller mentioned, for vets to get health care from the system. And the concern is it's just going to get worse.
And this is, as we've already heard from our callers, so we heard a woman whose father is a veteran of World War II. We heard a Vietnam veteran. So this is something we're going to be looking at in the future for a long time, it seems like.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Nancy Shute is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.